Okay, all right. I'll give you actually.
Okay. Couple quick announcements. March 26th is the day where we're gonna have 9 hours, okay, of project proposal workshop. It's gonna be a long day. It's not gonna be as long as June the 6th, 1945, but it's gonna be a long day. So it's gonna be BO2 CSL, okay? So it's an auditorium. So if you all of you show up, we still have enough seats, okay? March 26th, BO2 CSL. I actually tried to get this room, but there's no way we can get it for the whole day. Okay, so CSL BO2 is the only one. And I wanted to get a little more light during the day, so 301 would have been a better choice. But, you know, 301 is not available the whole day. However, there's a good news. It's actually available for our final presentation. Okay, so it's going to be more pleasant in the final presentation. So you're going to be seeing the light at the end of the tunnel in that room, right? So it's going to start at 9 o'clock sharp, and it goes all the way to 6 p.m. And we know it's going to be a long time. So I'm actually kind of scrapping together some budget so that we can actually have some coffee and drinks and food throughout the day. Okay, and you know, I still remember, you know, when we had these inhumane kind of, you know, marathon days in, you know, when I was in grad school, you know, my first question is, do you have food there? So, you know, I tried to answer that question, right? You know, I'm still trying to be sensitive here. So we're going to have, you know, some amount of drinks and snacks through the day, and we're going to break very briefly for lunch. You know, we're going to have essentially just a quick 30-minute lunch break, okay? And then we just, you know, go through the whole day. So any questions about this? Yes.
What day of the week is that?
Oh, that's Monday.
And what do we do if we have previous commitments? Like,
oh, yeah. You don't have to go to everyone. That's actually a good question. So I do realize that you have other classes and you probably have, you know, interviews whatsoever, you know what. So, you know, I assume that most of you can come to the morning part, right? And, you know, most of you can probably, you know, also come to the afternoon part. I'm not going to make it a requirement, okay? And but come to as many as you can, because you want to hear what other people's ideas are. And it will help you to refine your idea. It's part of the process. So, you know, I'm not going to check attendance. Remember that exam paper thing? You don't need to have, you know, 12 papers circulating, getting all the feedback. Okay, so there's no need to. Any other questions? Okay, so it's right after spring break. Okay, so don't forget. Okay? Any other? Okay, so there are a couple other things. Let me just quickly finish, you know what, the lecture yesterday. We just have about 5 minutes worth of stuff. And, you know, we talked about this hierarchical two-level, you know, padding. So this seems to be a quick, easy fix. You add an offset, and then you shift the offset by so many bits, the log of the number of banks again, and then you add it, right? So that should give you that hierarchical padding. So this is really meant to be, you know, what the first level padding looks like. So we're going to have the, you know, the 17th and 34th and 68th, you know, these are all padded in the first level. And then as soon as you get to the fourth one, it will kick in, right? So that will add one more. So instead of 272, you'll have 273. So every four, you'll have another level of padding, right? So that kind of gets rid of the additional, you know, the remaining bank conflicts. But that actually adds quite a bit of overhead. And in general, it does add about 4 cycles, okay, to each load and store. It's a ship and an add, okay? So those 4 cycles do give you a little bit more, you know, for the, you know, like the parallel execution, but it doesn't really give you additional kind of bad interaction effects. But when you add a second level padding, you're adding another 4 cycles to the threads. Okay? And at that point, it becomes much less clear if it is worth it for, you know, until it gets really, really big. Okay, the list that you're trying to reduce gets really big. Okay, just kind of quickly on this one again. When you do the, so remember, this is, originally we had this loop that will loop all the way until the very last thread being active. So we're reducing all the way down to the root of the tree. So what we're doing here is we break off early. So when B is 32, you break off. And at that point, you know that D is, you know, only 32 or less, right? And at that, so once you break out of this loop, you know, then you would say if the process ID is 32 or less, then these are the only ones that should participate, right? Because everyone else will be done by the end of this loop. And within this thing, you could have predicated or done the if then else, because not everyone with ID less than or equal to 32 need to do all these 6 steps. But you know, even if they did, it doesn't change the result. So you may as well just reduce the divergence by just allowing them to run all the way. So you can work out a little bit detail and then just convince yourself that the actual work doesn't change the result. Okay. So this will be one way to reduce the divergence. Okay, in the end of it. And it's meaningful in the sense that these guys are all going to be in the same warp, right? So this is where you want to reduce divergence. Okay? So finally, going back to this histogram median, this is what David actually talked about last time. And I saw this slide, I thought it was kind of, it's kind of interesting, so maybe we just kind of quickly do a refresh. So basically, this deals with the lack of atomic, you know, operation, the FetchNet or, you know, some kind of test and set kind of operation. So what we really wanted to do was we wanted to be able to, you know, to add a value to, you know, to the histogram values every time we see a particular, you know, particular value. However, you know, so we need to add one to the instance, but we don't know if, you know, someone else will override this, because, you know, you need to go and get the value, right? And then you add one and write it back. In the middle of it, someone else may have done so, right? So that's the classic problem. So what this thing does is it will actually, you know, essentially the histogram value is not just a single value. It's actually a word with, you know, with the top part being the thread ID, and then the bottom part being the value. And so whenever you read, you will just, you know, essentially increment, you will actually get the value, extract the value out, do the increment, and attach your own ID to it, right? And then you write it back. So this goes back to the memory system guarantee, I believe, that is, you know, if you have multiple writers to the same location, one of them will completely succeed and the others will just fail, instead of having this mixture of bits from various writes. So that guarantee allows you to be able to either write successfully to it, or someone else could just override it. And so then what you do is you immediately read it back and see if your ID, okay, is still the ID in that location. That is, someone else didn't overwrite you. So if your ID is still there, then you can tell that, you know, what you did was successful. And this essentially allows you to avoid a situation where both got the same value, both added one, and both thought that it was successful, and, you know, then you lost one, right? Essentially, that's what the classic problem is. The only thing about this, I think, and maybe you brought it up, that if you run into a very bad situation, this could just loop forever. Is it? Someone brought this up.
In general programming, that could loop forever, but right. In a single warp,
it's not going to loop throughout.
Exactly. So I just want to go back to that point. You know, with tightly synchronous, you know, kind of timing, you shouldn't be looping forever. And also, you know, in the general case, if you're not looking for 100% histogram, you may want to just limit the number of iterations, because, you know, statistically you shouldn't have too many of those failures anyway. So if you're willing to tolerate a little bit the inaccuracy of your histogram, you may want to just limit it to 10 or 20 iterations. And, you know, in general, statistically you should be able to succeed in about, you know, 3-4 iterations. So, you know, that should take care of by far all the cases. So David, is there any other thing? I think we probably covered most of the EDNs.
Yeah.
Good. So this is also our last day in this room, and so the ECE guys asked us to, you know, take a picture. So David, can you come up and we can take a picture together?
Move this out of the way.
Okay. So that we have a proof that this class actually
looks
existed.
Like we're talking and
yeah, maybe we, you know.
I'm gonna get my camera. Here we go.
Turn on my camera.
All right. Okay. So now we have the proof.
See, when the class actually happened.
Back from the graph, we just had the Microsoft shirt on.
Microsoft. Okay, so now John has, you know, very kindly agreed to give this lecture. And John has a long time experience working in the graphics world. And he also has been spending a lot of time working on parallel programming for VMD and scientific computing in general. So I think he's a perfect person to do two of the things. One is, you know, he recently has done a lot of, you know, initial experiments with GAD. So, you know, his experience here would definitely help. And that's why I arranged, you know, David and I thought that, you know, this will be a very good third part of this whole application, you know, application performance lecture. And the second one is John and Jim, and you know, are putting together quite a few final project, you know, possibilities. And you know, they actually have done a very good job collecting the background material and setting up some websites for these things. So I also want him to, you know, to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about some of these setups. And if nothing else, when you think about your own project, you should also, you know, try to emulate what they have done. And you know, this is going to be a really good learning experience if you can actually not only do the project, but you know, spend the time studying the background material and really understand at least one of the applications. Okay, so John?
Okay, do we have a...
Yes, we'll switch to input 3.
Okay. Should get a screen here in a second.
Oh, something's happening.
There you go. I need to flip it one more time so I can see it too. There we go. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about two of the applications that we've been playing with CUDA, which we already have some decent results for. One is an ion placement tool that's used in preparation of molecular dynamics simulations. And the other is a visualization program that I developed in the theoretical biophysics group called BMD. So the idea of the talk today is basically to show you guys some of the things that have worked well for us in testing CUDA with the software we developed. Basically, finding the performance critical parts of your program that you want to accelerate with CUDA, taking these performance critical modules and splitting them up into small pieces that can be made to run fast with CUDA and that are easy to debug, and wrapping those high performance modules in a sort of machine or accelerator independent way so that your main program doesn't have to worry about the details of CUDA or setting up and tearing down the connection with the GPU, and then managing all these resources now that there's more than just the CPU. So the first thing I'll tell you a little bit about is this ion placement tool. So in the process of getting a molecular structure ready to be simulated, one of the things that the researchers have to do is they take a a protein or a virus or one of these structures, and they have to replicate the real-life conditions that those biological structures live under. And so that usually means that they have to add a big water box, and they have to add ions, and they have to adjust various parameters in the structure so that it matches the actual real-life molecule that they want to understand. One of the attributes about this that's important is as the structure gets larger, the amount of computation you have to do gets larger as well. And as we start running these things on leadership class supercomputers, then although we have NAMD, which Jim develops, that runs these huge simulations on thousands of processors, the task of constructing those models and getting them ready to run on the supercomputer is becoming a big problem now that we have these large structures. And so we need some acceleration, either by multiple CPUs, CUDA, or whatever we can get to make that process faster. So this code has been around a while. I apologize for the crowded slide. Basically, it started life as a sequential program. It got revised numerous times by the application scientists, so it was actually written by physicists first, and it got revised until they got the results they were hoping for. We then took that code and sort of cleaned it up and worked with them to make it run faster. Even that that sort of revised version, though, early in 2006, we had one of our researchers in our group wanted to run a virus simulation with a little over 1 million atoms. And we determined that just adding the ions to that structure would have required 10 days of runtime on the fastest machine we had available in the lab, just for that one step. And that's assuming that they make no mistakes and the program goes exactly perfectly. That would have been the least time, and you know how deadlines are, right? So basically, he came to my office and said, "Hey, can you make this thing run faster? I'm desperate. I need to get this thing running immediately." And so he came over and we started tuning that C code and making it run on the Intel C compiler with vectorization, rewriting the loop so that it could take advantage of SSE. By the time we got done with that, it ran about 20 times faster. Even that still wasn't enough because it turned out they were going to have to do this many times and tweak various things. And so then we decided, all right, well, with some additional work, we can make this use multiple threads, and we'll get it to run, you know, maybe a factor of four faster, or a little five or eight faster, depending on what machine we use. And then more recently, as people have started working on even bigger structures with 4 million atoms on up, it's become a clear problem that even running these things on a big supercomputer to place the ions is starting to take a long time, and we would rather be able to do this quickly. And so this seemed like an ideal application for CUDA for various reasons that I'll go into in a little bit. Just to give you a quick summary, the CUDA version running on three GPUs runs faster than 300 processors, which I will not name until after I've double and triple checked all the results. But 300 CPUs, that's insane. It is insane until you think about how would a general purpose processor do if it were rendering graphics. It wouldn't do very well. It would probably be a similar performance ratio between the GPU and the CPU. So actually, if you can make the problem fit the GPU really well, you could possibly get a speed up in this realm, or maybe even better. And so this code that I'm going to show you today is still actually a work in progress, and I don't know that it can't run faster. It might be able to be made faster yet, so we'll just have to see. So the basic algorithm for calculating these ion placements involves calculating what's called a coulombic potential map, and so that's basically a 3D grid in space that surrounds the molecular structure. And at each point on the grid, we calculate a potential value, and that potential value is just simply the sum of the charges divided by the distance from that grid point to each atom. So if we have 1 million atoms for this grid point, we have to do this calculation 1 million times. So that's a very simple brute force calculation. There are other ways we hope to be able to do it, but this way is very easy to understand. We know what the numerical accuracy issues are, and we feel safe doing the calculation with this brute force method because we know that it gets good results scientifically. So basically we calculate this potential grid, we find the minimum value, so the most negative potential in the grid, and that is the point where we will place a new ion. When we put that ion there, we have to add its electrostatic contribution to all of the grid points, so that updates the whole grid, and we repeat that process until the map has, until we have all the ions placed and the process is finished. So, as you can imagine, there's a lot of work. If I have a million atom structure and I'm just adding one ion, well over 99% of the runtime is just calculating the initial potential map before we've even begun placing the ions. So even if we had a piece of code that only did that, that would be a huge performance increase for this particular application. So, and I already mentioned this. And this is a useful target as a first CUDA test program because we do many grid-based calculations involving various types of potentials and density calculations and things like that for the purposes of building structures and analyzing them, and actually even for visualization. So maybe the easiest way to see this is to look at actual C code. So this is the simplest and slowest C implementation you can basically write, the part of the code that calculates one 2D slice. So if we think of this 3D Rubik's Cube type grid, and we take one 2D plane of that cube, this is the loop that calculates one Z slice of that grid. And so basically all we're doing here is we're just calculating the position of the grid points, we're calculating the difference between the position of the grid point and the position of the atom that we're considering, and then we're dividing the charge by the distance to the, for between the grid point and the atom, and we're summing that in a potential energy accumulator. And then finally, when it's done, we set that energy into the final grid. And so that's basically what the code in plain C looks like. Nope, we would never use this code because it's terribly slow. There are various tricks that we use to make it much faster than this. So the things to be aware of with how this thing works are the voxel coordinates are computed on the fly, so we don't need to store those anywhere. So that's nice. The atom coordinates, in order to make that computation less expensive, we pre-translate the coordinates of all the atoms so that they're relative to the lower corner of the grid. And that way we don't have to do an additional translation calculation inside that inner loop. So that's a trick we do. We set everything up ahead of time so that we have less arithmetic to do. We have approximately 20 of these grid cells or voxels. I'll try to use the word voxel instead of grid and all that because of CUDA we have. These words mean multiple things. So these voxels, we have about 20 of those for every atom. So there's a much larger number of voxels than atoms. So that means in the inner loop, probably in the case of a CPU, we want to get as much of our data in cache as we can. So we choose to do the inner loop over the smaller data. So in that case, it would be the atoms. The same is also true of the GPU because we have these small on-chip memory buffers, we want to fit as much of the data in there as we can so that the inner loop can be very effective. Another trick we can use to further accelerate this calculation, since we're doing one whole plane at a time, we can already calculate the distance, the DZ value for that entire plane, and that can be calculated in health constant. And so instead of actually storing the atom XYZ coordinates, we store XY and DZ, or DZ squared. And if we go a step further, which we do in CPU implementation, because the CPU has so much work to do and has no help from any other buddies, it has to do, you know, one of these whole rows by itself. It's actually worth it for the CPU to recalculate a dy squared plus dz squared value at every single row. So that's an interesting observation that we can do that, and you'll see a version of this of the GPU code where we pull that trick back in later. And so that saves a lot of arithmetic operations and doesn't cost us anything storage-wise. So the thing that's a problem about this algorithm is it chews through the data very quickly. So it's very data hungry. This is actually a pretty simple calculation. You're just summing those partial distances squared and taking the square root, dividing that into the charge and adding that to an accumulator, and you're just tearing through this array of values. So we have to do things to hopefully improve that memory utilization, or to use those operands as many times as we can. And so on the GPU, we also have to worry about bank conflicts, and we have to find ways to overlap fetches from global memory with those floating point operations. And then another trick we use is when we tile the potential map with thread blocks, we, on the GPU, want to pad out that map so it's evenly divisible by that thread block size. And so that eliminates the necessity to do any tests inside that inner loop. And we can just fill these values with zeros or just not copy them back to the host CPU when we're done. And so that's another nice thing for performance. So the basic process on the GPU looks something like this. We allocate buffers on the host CPU and on the GPU. If we are continuing an existing ion placement, we are working in sort of an additive mode. So we have an already existing potential map, and we're just going to add additional potential values to what's already there. So we have, instead of clearing it, we're just going to take one that already exists and sum into it. So then we're basically going to do whatever pre-processing tricks need to be done for the atoms that we're calculating. And then we start looping over slices using this pre-calculated atom group. And then basically, for some of the GPU algorithms, we will have to iterate over blocks of atoms because they won't all fit on the card at the same time. And so that's some of them. When we use things like texture memory, we have a lot of space, so we don't have to do that. In the case of constant memory, we have to do it maybe hundreds of times in order to get through a large number of atoms. And then so basically we go through that iteration, and then we complete the whole grid and we free everything up. So it's pretty straightforward, but the different algorithms use different variations of that inner loop depending on where they're storing the atom values and so on. So as far as tiling this potential map with thread blocks, 16 by 16 2D thread block turns out to be a pretty reasonable size because that gives us 256 threads, which is a decent starting point with CUDA. And it's also not too large of a tile. So that tile, if we have this padded array at the edge, this is all waste work at the edge, but it's not too bad if it's only, you know, 16, you know, worst case you're doing 15 by 15 that don't matter. So it's a minor fragmentation there. If we do more than one voxel per thread, which some of the variations of the code will do, that tile will either get bigger or the number of threads in the thread block will get smaller. So there, each one of the samples that I've written, you'll see they have minor variations on that thread block size and on the size of the tiles that divide up the grid. Okay. So the first version, this isn't the sequential order in which I wrote them, but I'm going to present them in order of performance and the things that I tried that panned out and the things that didn't for this application. It'll be different for everybody's program. So the first one I wrote is based on storing the atom coordinates in texture memory. So the advantages of this strategy, at least at the time I came up with it, is the texture memory is big. It's read-only. The atoms are read-only. We can download millions of atoms into texture memory at one go, and we can process all of the slices without ever having to reload the atoms, at least for the size molecules we're working on now. The disadvantage to this is that the texture memory isn't as fast as the shared memory or the const memory. So these other strategies that I'll show you in a little bit, few minutes, actually do a lot better for this particular case. So, and we're not taking advantage of some of the hardware features that texture memory provides. We don't need things like interpolation. We're not benefiting from the 2D locality of the referencing those texture values. And so it's sort of, although texture memory might work well for many other applications, in this one we're just not taking advantage of what it has to offer. So I chose to go a different route with the next versions.
So for all these little, I've tried to squeeze a readable amount of code onto these slides, but they're tiny little snippets of the real thing. And I've put the real thing up on the 498 web page that we've been managing, and you can get this from this PowerPoint later. So that's where you can get all these. So this is the innermost loop of the texture-based version. Another problem that I had with the texture version is the addressing to get these atom values out of this big texture map is much more complicated than it is for some of the other versions I wrote. And that's because although the texture memory is big, you can't have an infinite number of coordinates in any particular direction. I think the largest, since I was using four float textures, so they're float fours, the most I could have was 16,384 in any dimension. So that works out to like 64,000 if it was one float. So because of that texture size limitation, I have to pack all those atoms into a 2D array, and so then we have to do all this addressing calculations in the innermost loop, which is unfortunate. And so that slows things down a little bit relative to the other ones. This could still be made faster, but because I got so much better results using a different strategy, I didn't pursue it anymore. It might still be possible to make this one run twice as fast by doing some of the tricks, which I will show you in the next few slides. So this one that I will go into next is based on storing the atoms in the constant memory, which is the small 64K memory buffer. It's so small that there is no way we will be able to store all the atoms. So the advantage of constant memory is it's very simple to address the contents of it. Since we have to reload all of those atom values anyway, it's no big deal for us to pre-compute things like the dz squared value for the whole slice. Because all of the threads will loop over the same atom at the same time, we get that magic almost as fast as a register performance. So that's a key factor. That was the thing that attracted me to this variation of the algorithm, was the fact that I could do that. Since we can't store all the atoms, that means we're going to have to loop over this kernel many times, potentially. So 4,000 atoms at a time. If I have a 4 million atom system, I've got to run 4,000 kernels before that single slice has had all those potential contributions. So that just means that the host code has more bookkeeping to do, because it has to remember which atoms have been done, which ones haven't, and do all the right copies to get everything where it needs to be. But it actually goes quite fast. I mean, 150 gigaflops, to give you an idea, I think the fastest version I wrote for with the Intel compiler and SSE and all of that on the Core 2 quad CPU with one core was about 4 gigaflops or 3 gigaflops, something around that range. So this is already a huge increase in performance over what the best version we had on the CPU was.
So John, was that the double precision or single?
Single precision.
So it's
in fact,
it's really a
to use the SSE on the widest variety of chips, it has to be single precision to get the maximum number, the maximum width of SIMD. And for this application, it's okay for us to do the calculation in single precision. There's, you know, we have concerns about that for other cases where we may not be able to do that. But for placing the ions, since we're just looking for a minimum, the relative error, as long as the relative error is within a reasonable range for all of these potential values, it's okay.
So your production runs, you also use single precision?
Yeah. Yeah, and the CPU code was single precision also also to get more speed. if you have to wait 3 months to run it, your competitor's published already, so maybe it didn't matter. So the kernel structure for this one is actually a little easier to read. The DZ value is already pre-computed, so it's instead of being calculated here, it's just looked up out of that constant memory. You can see there are, in this version of the code, we have 9 floating point operations if you count them up, and we have 4 floating point loads into registers. Now these are still coming from fast memory, they're coming from constant memory, so it's almost as fast as reading it right out of a register,
But they're not entirely free because they have to be read into a register before we can operate on them. And so that means that we do lose some performance just because they're not already there. So that because it eats instruction slots. And so an obvious thing we might be able to do is to change things around so that we reuse more of those atom values by keeping them in a register and operating on them more than once. So this, oh, and the other thing here is that we have to read whatever the original potential value is in that slice, since we have to do this in an iterative fashion. So we start, the first thing we do once we calculate the final voxel address is we immediately read whatever's there before we begin doing all the heavy lifting on calculating all those atoms. By the time we've processed 4,000 atoms, that read should have been long since completed, and by the time we get to here, it's in a register and we're ready to write that out, and then the kernel's done. So then the next stage was basically trying that idea of keeping more of our data in the registers, not having to repetitively load those atom values, even though they're coming from fast constant memory, it's not free. So basically this uses that dy squared plus dz squared pre-calculation trick within the inner loop calculation. So we're sort of doing the same thing we used to do on the CPU. We don't have enough resources to do an entire row like we could on the CPU, but just doing it over four voxels at a time is already a huge benefit in terms of reducing the number of arithmetic operations and improving the ratio of arithmetic to loads and stores. A disadvantage of this method is we cannot do this automatically with the compiler, at least not yet. Some compilers might be that smart, but a lot of compilers, even on a CPU, in my experience, aren't smart enough to do this particular transformation. So that means we have to do this by hand, and it's kind of, it expands the code and makes it harder to read, but it does run faster, so we're willing to live with that pain. And the other disadvantage, of course, is we have various finite resources. We only have so many registers. As this code expands and uses more registers, that starts to put pressure on the number of blocks that can be scheduled on the GPU at once.
So, and John,
yes?
How many registers does this one use?
I think this one is exactly 20.
Per thread?
Yes, per thread. The version that was not unrolled, I believe, used 10. And I don't want to say anything firm because I could do a lot more experiments before I'm sure about all these things. David's guys probably actually know exactly how the scheduling works. But one of the things I observed when trying all these things, I didn't try every possible number of registers because you actually have to write code to make it have a different register count, and only so many versions actually do something useful. But I observed that the performance had a direct relationship with that register usage because it has a lot to do with how many of those blocks are there to be overlapped when you're doing these memory operations. And so we're starting to get the code, you know, at 226 gigaflops, it's almost twice as fast as the previous version. It's now getting real close to running, you know, as fast as we can on the hardware using this strategy at least. We're running with almost as many registers as we can. I've had various versions of this that tried to do more, like unrolling it by 8. Unrolling it by 8, it crashes. It goes right off the cliff, and it runs half as fast as this because of that resource contention issue and not being able to co-schedule as many of those blocks. And the other thing to note about this...
So when you unroll by 8,
yeah,
mostly it's the register usage.
Yes. It's right. Directly, it's blowing up the register use by a factor 2, going from 10 to 20. And the other factor that's important to realize is because each thread is doing more than one voxel, you then have two choices. Either the thread block size will be decreased and the tile size remains constant. So I either go from 16 by 16 to, say, 8 by 16, and then each one is doing 4 or... 4 by 16 is the version that I think this one's using. So then, instead of 256 threads, we have 64, and each one is doing 4 values in the x direction. So that's sort of it's the danger zone. It's right on the edge of what you're able to
effectively use with CUDA, but in fact it runs faster for this particular code. Or your other choice is you leave the thread block size constant and the tile in the map for that thread block, the amount of work that it's actually computing gets twice or four times bigger. And so the only problem with that is you now have a bigger padding size at the end, and so you have more waste work to do, and it also means that you have a much lower number of thread blocks in any particular dimension. So if somebody wants to calculate a map that's very short in the X direction, you might only get one of those blocks.
So that's problematic also. You had a question? Oh, okay. So.
And this unrolled version basically looks like this. So instead of, the reason the register use goes way up is not only do we have more calculations in the inner loop, but because of that memory fetching latency that we have to hide, we have four of those potential value loads at the beginning, which have to go in somewhere, they have to sit in a register. Then the inner loop is running, and then at the very end, those final energy accumulators get added to those values that we already fetched while this was running. So that's one of the reasons the register count goes way up very quickly, is we have need to buffer those slow global memory fetches, and we also have more intermediate values to compute inside the inner loop.
You'll find interesting things with the current version of the compiler. I think I wrote this probably 15 times trying every trick I could think of to reduce the number of registers, but at the current time, this particular compiler likes to use registers. So I don't know, some of the tricks I tried didn't have any effect on the code. So you'll have to, and it's worth reading the PTX to see what is the compiler doing with this. How did I get 20 registers? I look at the code and I think, 20 registers, are you kidding me? But that's how it is. And
there's probably a reason.
I'm sure there are reasons.
They use these small boards, right? So if you reuse registers, you could have, you know, false dependencies in the small board.
Yeah, see, I assume that there are very good reasons and that they know more than I do. But as a programmer, I want to know what is it actually doing, and what can I do to my code to reduce, if that register count is becoming a bottleneck for me because of the scheduling, then maybe I want to do something to my code to change things around a little bit, was my rationale.
Yeah, the thing is, it's not necessarily to, you know, defend the compiler writers. It's more like, because of that consideration, it may not be, the situation may not change anytime soon. It's going to be a very subtle balance for them to change from the current state to a more aggressive reuse.
Okay. So, yeah, and while I'm on that topic, you may wonder, why did I write this, scaling by the inverse of the square root that way? Because that way, the compiler generates a reciprocal square root instruction. If I just divide by square root f, it actually doesn't. It calculates square root and then does a division, which is slow, so it runs 30% slower if I write it the straightforward way. So that's why it looks odd, is because this runs fast with the current compiler.
And you can't use the reduced precision intrinsics for that.
I looked and didn't find one for the square root values. I started digging through the header files in the CUDA compiler, but I didn't see any square root intrinsics yet. So I'm going to request those.
Yes.
And they know about this stuff. I don't know. There may be reasons why the compiler does this. What was important to me was finding a way around it so that I didn't, so I got the performance I wanted. So then I made one more variation on this, and as you can see, the performance went up a little bit, but not a lot. And so what I did for this one was, up until now, none of the versions I wrote have been using the shared memory. And the reason was because the access patterns and so on for the atoms, I wasn't sure that it would be a win to do it that way. And I didn't see, it didn't seem like as strong a guarantee that I'd get the performance I was after. So I just didn't worry about using shared memory in the earlier versions. So the idea with this one was, since the number of registers being used was becoming problematic, and I had already tried unrolling that loop by 8 and seen the performance go off the cliff, I thought, well, maybe what I'll do is those reads from global memory at the very beginning of the code, instead of storing those in registers while that inner loop runs, maybe I will store them in the shared memory instead, and then thus free up 8 of those registers. And so actually, I made a variation of the code that does exactly this. With the shared memory and unrolling by a factor of 8 instead of 4, it does save a lot of registers, but it's now 21 instead of 20. And the if you run the CUDA profiler just using 21 instead of 20, there's some magic number of registers there, because the CUDA profiler reports a much lower GPU occupancy number for this code than it does for the simpler one. And I assume, but I can't prove, that it's because of the number of registers being one more than some important value. And so this was only a net gain of about 5% performance. And there may be various other things that we can do to improve this, but this version has gone as far as that strategy can, because we're using all of the cons to memory, something like 70% of the shared memory, and you know, the number of registers is clearly becoming an issue for the scheduling of these blocks. And so to get past 235 gigaflops, we know the hardware can do better, so there must be a way somehow. But I haven't figured it out yet. And so basically this one basically loads those 8 potential values at startup, processes the inner loop 8 at a time, does all the same things, but the code is huge. This is like when May was talking about these things start getting ugly very fast. So if you have to manually unroll these loops, the code becomes hideous, and unless you knew, let's always keep the simple version of the code around. It's a lot easier to go to the ugly state than back from the ugly state. So that's why you keep that slow, simple, easy to read C version around, because by the time you get to this, a normal person will never figure out what it was actually doing. They'll read that and just shake their head and go, huh, I'm starting over.
So John,
yeah.
Any insight about the difference in terms of easiness or efficiency between constant memory and texture memory?
Well, I think that David explained some of the reasons why I hadn't seen the performance I was expecting initially from the texture memory, because it's a more sophisticated piece of hardware and it has more machinery to engage to do what it does. There's going to be a little more overhead in using it than something that's lightweight and simple and, you know, very easy to design in the hardware. And so the texture memory, I think it would be a win if I was able to use the locality pattern better. If I had a few more floating point operations per iteration of that loop, it probably would be a no-brainer. Probably the texture memory would have won.
Also, the other big things that texture memory has going for it are the array addressing.
Yeah.
And the interpolation also, neither of which you're using.
Right. I wonder, you know, for example, one of the projects that we're interested in involves doing convolutions and things like that, and doing interpolation of grid values and all of these things. That seems like a natural candidate for using. It almost seems ridiculous not to use the hardware that's already there for that. But for this one, I just couldn't find a way to use it effectively.
So how did you get around the array addressing problem?
Oh, in which one? In this one?
In the fourth.
The array addressing is basically the same in this as it is in the other ones. It's the only variation in the fourth one versus the third and the second is just that unrolling. The addressing is still very simple because that's done once for that entire, for one thread block. Each thread is calculating its output address at the beginning, and while that does involve a lot of arithmetic, because of the number of dimensions and so on, there are probably 15, 20 float operations just or in operations calculating that address. But then we're going to do a million atoms of heavy lifting in the inner loop, and so it's not a big cost. Or at least in the const version, there are going to be 4,000 iterations for every one time we calculate those addresses. So it's not too bad. But for the texture one, that we had additional addressing to do on the inner loop, and that's where it was troublesome. So I'm getting close to running out of time here, so I'll try to get moving faster. It's pretty easy to parallelize this computation because we have all this massively data parallel calculation. We can also divide it up into slices, and we can cycle over those slices with independent CPUs or GPU threads. And since we have typically got a grid with, say, 500 slices in the z-axis, a simple strategy of just doing it along the z-axis pays off quite well, and we can use hundreds of processors very easily, and so that's not a problem. So with three of those GPUs running concurrently with the fastest version of the code, we get about 705 gigaflops total. So there's one host thread for each GPU. One of the complications is because CUDA is sort of OpenGL-like in that you have a context associated with every thread that's sort of implicit. So when you create the thread that's going to talk to a GPU, it binds to whatever GPU it first communicates with, and once it's done that, it's talking to that GPU for from then on. And so you can't change it after it's been set, at least not in this version. Yeah, and so that's a tricky thing. So you have to do all this CUDA setup inside the child thread to make sure that it gets the GPU it's supposed to have and that, you know, everything is set up correctly. But the problem with this is if something happens, an error occurs, maybe the GPU ran out of memory or who knows what, now you're in a child thread and you have all these error conditions to deal with. Thread, you know, it's a lot easier with multi-threaded programs to not do that stuff in the child threads because it's hard to pass information back and forth with the original host program. And so this makes dealing with errors that occur after the child threads have been created somewhat problematic. So that would be one thing that would be nice to revise in the future would be, because by the time you get to actually spawning all these threads, you don't want to then have to stomp on the brakes and halt GPUs that are already off and running because one out of three of them had problems or something like that. So that's one tricky thing. So you guys, if you start doing that, you'll have to figure out what to do there. And that's, of course, very system dependent because every thread library works a little differently. One thing to watch out for when you have a simple decomposition like this, even though we have all these independent slices, they end up writing their results into a contiguous block of memory. And if those slices were very small, you could get what's called false sharing, where a bunch of threads are writing their results to the same page. On a NUMA machine, that's a huge performance hit. So on some of the big SGI machines or even some of the Opterons, you can have a big performance hit if there's a bunch of nearby, overly close memory accesses. Even if they don't actually step on each other, just if they're in the same page, that can cause a lot of problems. So, but we're lucky because these typically one of these slices is a few megabytes, and unless you're using a system with large page size, it won't be a problem. So another interesting factoid is that with three GPUs running full bore and all four CPU cores running, we had a little load to one of them just to see. Our little test box uses 700 watts, which isn't too bad, actually.
So you actually have enough power for another GPU if you have another slot.
Oh, yeah. And I was looking. They make four PCI Express slot boards now, so maybe.
Because I'd like to see that hit a teraflop.
I would, too. that's why I was saying there's still performance possible. Knowing the general range of gigaflops that the hardware can do, it kills me that I haven't gotten to a gigaflop yet, so I want to get there one way or another.
Well, maybe it's just a little short, though.
Or teraflop, yeah.
Some of the CUDA rock stars are going to take a look at your code later this week, so.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of things that I didn't do as well as it could have been done, so I'd love to hear about it. And at least they have a starting point and say, you know, I did most of the hard work, so.
Yeah.
Another 10% four cars?
We got it.
You're there.
Yeah. Let's see. So that's what the test box looks like.
These rear slots get pretty warm, actually.
It's pretty amazing though. You know, you look, it's a little box, looks like a normal PC, but it's, you get a little grin on your face when you walk into the machine room and you think there's a 0.7 teraflop number cruncher sitting right there. And so, and they're cheap too. So to give you an example, some of the calculations we're doing with this would have taken 300 processors on a big cluster or supercomputer to run at the same rate. And they cost a lot more than that and use a lot more electricity and power than that. So this is very, very exciting.
Yeah, I think the punchline for that slide ought to be priceless.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. So, yeah, so now, so one of the things, this didn't bite me as bad as Jim. Jim has a, so I like showing this potential grid problem because it's very easy. It's funny because as I was writing these slides and I got to about 20 slides, I thought, wow, so much for being easy. But it's easy compared to some of the things that Jim's working on with calculating forces in NAMD and some of these other algorithms that involve calculating histograms and so on, because we don't have any of the synchronization issues to worry about. It's just a brute force number crunching problem. As you start getting into some of those log-in step algorithms and doing data exchanges between shared memory slots and all that stuff, you start trying to be very crafty with your addressing arithmetic. And in those cases, sometimes the compiler is doing things we wish it wouldn't. And one way you can determine whether or not it's doing what it ought to be doing, or what you were hoping it was going to do, is to basically read the PTX output. Unlike, I don't know if you guys have ever looked at the assembly output of one of the, you know, Intel compilers or something like that. One of the nice things about PTX is it doesn't have 100,000 opcodes. It's got probably, I don't know, 50 or 100. So it's a small, easy to understand instruction set. I've never seen a PTX manual in my life, but I can just run that, compile to PTX and read and say, oh, okay, yeah, I know what's going on here. I have discovered after talking to some of the NVIDIA guys that even the PTX isn't exactly what's running on the hardware though. So I reported a bug that if you do integer division by 2, the compiler's optimizer doesn't figure that out and convert it into a right shift by 1, and so I complained about that. And they wrote me back and said, well, yeah, it's in PTX it shows up as a divide still, but actually there's another optimizer that runs on the PTX that converts that to the machine code. And so I then, you know, wrote back, and I haven't heard yet, but there may be yet more to it than this, and I don't know how you can disassemble, I don't know if you can disassemble a CU bin file or a .o file to see what the optimizer really did in the final end.
Not at this time.
Yeah, and I didn't know if that was something you were likely to...
Not in general either.
Yeah, right. I mean, the goal for PTX is it's the assembly interface that we expect to be able to maintain compatibility with.
Right.
So... you know, you really don't want to look under the hood too much below that, because any discovery you make is liable to be tenuous.
Right. But in the case...
But I mean, think in this case, yeah. that ought to be optimized out at a higher level.
Right. Well, they filed it as not a bug, so that made me, you know, then ask, well, okay, then how can I figure out what actually happened in the end, yeah.
So, in fact, there may even be a... possibility that other optimizer gives a brief summary of what the PTX really should have looked like instead of exposing
the real assembly
file.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
Yeah, that's why I said not at this time.
Yeah.
There are
ways. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot that can be done, and hopefully we'll get to it.
Yeah. So the other observation I had about all that stuff is that it's a heck of a lot easier to figure out what's happening in a very small test program where the CUDA kernel is this long and you don't have all the other details to worry about. So just this, you know, the four versions that I showed today are not the only four versions I wrote. I probably wrote 20 versions of this code, and I very quickly, and it helped me to learn what is a good idea and what's a bad idea, what works, what doesn't work. Jim, similarly, I don't know how many versions of the NAMD stuff you've written, but, you know, all these things, it's a lot better to start with a smaller piece of test code to begin with. And then also you're not worrying about, you're not subject to the effects of the big application. You know, if you have a program the size of BMD with 500,000 lines of code, there can be all sorts of funny things with the CPU cache being filled with other data that isn't needed by the kernel, and it'll affect the performance or your timings of the kernel. Whereas if you just run a tiny little piece of test code, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. It's CPU was empty when it started, so you're not getting all those things happening. So I wanted to, I don't know, how am I doing on time?
You're fine.
Okay. So I wanted to talk a little bit about other things. So much like the ion placement code, my main day job is actually writing VMD, which is our molecular visualization tool. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about what I've learned so far in integrating CUDA into a much bigger program and sort of organizing the software around it and so on. So the excitement is our researchers in our group and in many all over the world are doing simulations of ever larger molecular structures. Not only, you know, as I said at the beginning, not only are the NAMD runs that go on the supercomputers getting bigger and bigger and using more processing power, but just the act of building these models, visualizing them, and analyzing what happened in the supercomputer simulation is becoming a big deal to be able to perform at all. So for some of the things that we want to be able to do, like the example I already showed and some that are very similar, we can do analyses in CUDA now on a desktop that would have previously required running VMD. VMD, besides running with graphics, for this very reason, can also be run with no graphics in sort of a batch mode where just the number crunching features of the program and the scripting languages can be used. So that people often run analysis jobs on the supercomputer. With CUDA, some of this stuff, at least things that map well to the GPU, can now be done on their desks, which is a lot more convenient. They don't have to wait for a queue. They don't have to, you know, find an idle supercomputer that has a 256 processor block-free, things like that. So it makes their lives a lot easier. Some of the challenges that occur with a program like VMD, VMD is a big piece of software. You know, there are 500,000 lines of C and C++, probably another 250,000 lines of scripting and in TCL and Python, and the end users are not computer programmers, they're physicists and biochemists and chemists and so on, and so we don't expect they would be able to compile VMD from source. So that means we have to, the versions of VMD that we make available to the community have to run on whatever machine they've got. If it has a CUDA accelerator, great. If it doesn't, it still has to run. It can't abort. We can't afford also, because I'm the only programmer working on VMD, we can't afford to make a lot of special versions of VMD that have unusual features. So it's better for me to find a way to make the main version have all the features. So the challenge here is that then it has to be smart enough to discover what resources are out there, build tables of all these resources, and then it has to decide at runtime how many processors to use, how many GPUs to use, what programmable shading features are available on X hardware, and to deal with whatever policies are enforced by the user. So I'll get to that in a second.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
If there were a high performance CPU runtime for CUDA,
mm-hmm.
so that you could have your CUDA code run either on GPU or on multi-core CPU relatively efficiently for, mm-hmm. for the substrate, would that make your life easier? Or would you still do a full-on CPU implementation and a full-on GPU implementation?
I have an answer for you. Well, we could use that, but I guarantee you, you won't port that to every platform that we're required to run VMD on. So unless you do Solaris, Iris, yeah, I mean, you guys are going to write an Iris version? No. You know, Solaris, Iris, all the versions of Linux, macOS. Yeah, I mean, I still have to run on those. So while I might very well take advantage of it, there might be reasons why it's better to use that runtime than the hand-coded version, because maybe you guys have a bunch of assembly maniacs that have made some really sweet intrinsics that make it run faster, and I don't have time to write machine code, so I use the CUDA accelerator library instead. I might still use it, but it won't save me from having to do the grunge work for the platforms that aren't interesting for NVIDIA. Yeah. So that's the only catch, is if you want to run on, and you know, of course, VMD still has to run on Uncle Bob's new supercomputer that just got put together yesterday, because the users want to be able to do their trajectory analysis on the big machine without downloading a 30 gigabyte file over the slow internet. So that's the other, sort of another problem I have. So another trick is, how do you make your application deal with sort of the random availability of some of these features at runtime? Well, the easy way is you try the GPU, and if that doesn't pan out, then you fall back to the CPU. In the case of this ion placement code, though, it's kind of funny because we're not talking about a factor of two in performance. We're talking about either you run it on the GPU or you better sign up for your supercomputer account, because you're never going to finish if you run it on your desktop. So what do you do if the GPU version is hundreds of times faster? The calculation you might have wanted to perform just may not be practical at all to run on your desktop. So falling back blindly to the CPU might be a big problem, actually. And that's actually the case. Some of the stuff I've already added with CUDA, if there's no GPU, they aren't going to want to do it. It'll be, you know, it's either there or they go home. Because so doing it without the GPU is suicide.
Going back to David's question, you know, if the bar is truly raised, that is, the standard is 100 times more than the CPU, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't a lot of those platforms fall by the wayside very quickly?
They might.
For your
it's
users?
Certainly, yeah, I mean, that's another way to look at it, but you're still going to have the person with the laptop.
Oh, sure.
And they might wish that they could do this. It just means it's a challenge for me, because I have to design the graphical user interface so that they don't send me an email when they discover some menu option says no, you know, or tells them, no, not going to run this calculation on this machine. I have to then do a bunch of extra work so that the ease of use isn't impacted by the fact that, look, we do provide this wonderful feature, but it depends on you having a CUDA accelerator. If you don't have one, you know, too bad.
Yeah, that's something that David and I probably should, you know, think about a little bit more. That is, you know, if you look at the PC world, a lot of these games, right, begin to have these minimal requirements. And, you know, you're out of luck if you had your uncle's PC from 40 years ago.
Right.
Or
they no longer, most games no longer have a CPU fallback.
Right.
And in fact, many modern games don't even have a like one version back of DirectX fallback. If it's a DirectX 9 game and you have DirectX 8, well, upgrade your graphics card. Right? There are actually games that you load it up on older hardware and it says, go buy a new graphics card.
Right. So basically, what these things are keeping up, and you raise the bar enough.
I mean, another way to look at this, and you know, this is my dream of how the world will be, is you know, you wouldn't actually think of running a program on your PC without a CPU in it.
Yeah.
Right? Where would it run? So if you want to do arithmetic acceleration, you know, why would you think of running it in a computer that doesn't have an accelerator? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, when the price is low enough, this can happen.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, we already faced some of those. It's just like with video games. I'm faced with the problem of, well, I have users running on hardware that doesn't have programmable shading. I have users running on hardware that ostensibly has it, but it's so buggy it's unusable. And then I have users that actually have functioning hardware. And I want not to have to maintain all these variations of the code for all the combinatorial possibilities of what they have. And it's sort of the same deal. So some of the features, if they don't have programmable shading, it's just going to say no. Or another very common one that was initially very problematic on PCs was 3D texture mapping. It's the same thing. If you either have it or you don't. And if you don't have it, sorry. I get a lot of emails, even now, from people who are still using antique hardware. It's just like, come on. Did I get through all that? Yeah. So, you know, this problem already existed. It's not anything specific to CUDA. It's just that CUDA adds another layer of this issue to all the software we already have. Another problem that's kind of interesting is deciding when it's better to run on the CPU or run on CUDA. For some size kernels, I think one may mention this, if you're doing a little 4x4 matrix multiply, maybe you don't want to run it on CUDA because the setup time and the teardown time will be more than the arithmetic. Another case that could happen is besides the actual calculation you want to perform, is what the situation is on the machine you're running on. It might be a reasonable, like making decisions on where this should run. It might be perfectly reasonable for VMD to grab all of the CPUs and create worker threads on all the CPUs that exist on the single user desktop workstation. But when VMD is run on one of the supercomputer centers and the user logs into the compile node and runs something to process a trajectory, it would be considered rude or illegal for VMD to just soak up the whole machine for its own greedy purpose. So there are different cases that have to be solved there. And then, of course, you have the situation of what if a user is running one instance of VMD doing heavy number crunching, which is going to take 3 days, even with CUDA, and there will be those situations. And then they run another copy of VMD that they're going to use for interactive visualization. Well, now you have both programs sort of vying for the same pool of resources. What should they do? You know, should they dynamically load balance what they run on what hardware? How to deal with that, I don't know the answer to. I think CUDA, I did some little tests and tried to kill the driver, but it actually does pretty well. If two things try to run kernels at the same time, two independent processes, it will interleave the kernels. But when one has it, the other one doesn't have it. And so the only thing with that is for interactive, it's more tricky, but for batch, it would be totally fine, I think. But that's still interesting. You might, if you expect to run a kernel very quickly, you might not want it to use a CUDA resource that's being used by somebody else. Maybe if there was a way to, you know, just like we have a way of judging load on a CPU, maybe if there was a call you could judge activity rate of a CUDA accelerator, a program could say, ooh, this one's being heavily used, let's stay off that one.
Yeah.
Sort of integrated the CUDA kernels into VMD. I talked to Jim because we'll have to do the same thing with NAMD and many of our other codes. One interesting strategy we came up with is basically making a single header file that contains the prototypes for all of our CUDA accelerated kernels, and then basically putting each of the CUDA kernels in its own CU file. The reason for putting them all in their own CU file is because if they use things like const memory, which is sort of a file scope declaration. If you have multiple kernels in one file and they both use const memory, they'll actually chew up the resource, even though they're never going to run at the exact same time. So those are things to be aware of. By putting them in separate files in different compilation units, then they'll get along and everybody's happy. Let's see. And then I took a very simple approach to dynamically assigning the work. Basically, if there's a GPU, a CUDA GPU available, there's a little, the original routine now is a wrapper in it, and I've renamed the original CPU function to a new one. And it just basically looks, says, is there CUDA? If there is, run it over there, otherwise fall back to the CPU. And something that I want to do, but haven't really gone the full distance with, is basically building up a larger, higher level smart wrapper that knows more about the global use of these resources, that can monitor how fast they're turning around executions and things like that. And it's, yeah, he's got an evil smile on his face. And basically make those decisions or keep some sort of pool of attributes so you know when it's a good idea or not. Then that's sort of like your project, right?
My thesis is avoiding having to do that application.
Well, get it done.
I have a working prototype.
Good. I'm just teasing. Yeah, exactly. Because otherwise, that's the problem. Otherwise, every application has to do this for itself, and it has to work with incomplete knowledge of
exactly
what's happening. Yeah. And that's but we already have these problems in other places, so it's a familiar issue, but it would be great if they didn't have to do this and we could just make a call and say, this is what we want, tell us what to do. Yeah, and
it's
so the,
than that.
What's that?
It's even simpler than that.
Yeah. And so then the code for basically falling back becomes something like this, you know, set the condition to error, try to run it on CUDA if CUDA's been enabled in the compilation. If there was an error, then fall back to the CPU. And that's what I've done so far. It's pretty simple minded, but it'll work in the short term. And that's it.
Very good. So
thanks.
Hey. Thanks. So, a couple of things. Can you quickly show the website to everyone?
I don't think I have wireless.
Yeah, right here.
Okay.
While you bring up, so this was the. Yeah. Okay.
I think CoinWay put the link on there on the main website yesterday, so it should be on the class page now, but.
So I also realized something. I was just looking at the file names and said, you know, there's a reason why CUDA was taught, you know, in Urbana-Champaign. It's Champaign-Urbana. See you.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
So all the files are Champaign-Urbana files. Anyway, there's one more thing I forgot to mention this morning. You notice that there's a, you know, March 26th proposal workshop, right? And there's a May 2nd. Final project presentation. What I'd like you to do, in fact, the TAs and I and David need to figure out exactly how the logistics work, is that we need to have an intermediate checkpoint to essentially give you a sort of an intermediate deadline for you to at least have one, you know, working version going by that time. So, which is probably going to be right around April 15th. So we're going to, you know, define some kind of intermediate checkpoint which will give you incentive to get to the point that it's not going to add a whole lot of overhead on the essentially. Okay. So by that time, you should be able to have one, you know, preliminary implementation, and you should be able to explain the stuff. Okay. And you know, at that point, hopefully, we can actually find some time to give you a little bit of feedback. Okay, for that thing, and then we'll go on. Okay. So, John, do you have the website?
Mm-hmm. So, we came up with a list of potential projects that we thought would be a decent match for CUDA and for the time that you guys will have in the class. One may have said that he figured you guys would have like 50, 60 hours to burn on each of these projects. So we tried to come up with a real project that's actually going to do something interesting, but is yet still achievable and without superhuman, you know, killing yourself.
Yeah.
So some of the suggested projects, one that I wrote is basically calculating molecular surfaces. One of the things we do in visualization with these multi-million atom structures is we calculate surfaces over these structures, and besides these potential grids, we also have various types of three-dimensional density maps. There are a lot of well-known isosurface extraction algorithms and density map synthesis algorithms, and if you combine the two, you can have a tool that will basically run on the GPU and either extract isosurfaces from existing density maps or create a surface as it calculates density on the fly. And so I've made a project that's sort of based on that, and I have example codes for all these things that you can start with in plain C. Some of them are more tricky than others because of the way the algorithms work. Some you'll have to worry about things like the synchronization and sorting outputs and things like that, dealing with divergence. Others will be easier. This lattice cutoff computation for multi-level summation. So the direct summation method that I described today is one way you can calculate these potential maps. Another way you can do it, which has much better algorithmic efficiency, is to use an approximate method that uses multiple resolutions of meshes and does a bunch of fancy convolutions and numerical analysis and gets the same result. And if you have the direct sum is, you know, the time complexity is the number of voxels multiplied by the number of atoms. As the thing gets bigger, it gets huge. So even with a GPU, we will eventually wish that it was faster. So this method is n plus m instead of n times m. And so it's very exciting from a performance point of view. It might give us another factor of 50. we have to do more evaluation on the numerical accuracy. But and that can also be used in a tool like NAMDI. So they're hoping to use multi-level summation methods for force evaluations in a future version of NAMDI. So that's also very exciting.
Question?
I'm sorry to inject a physics question here. When you have these ion placements,
mm-hmm.
the first thing that pops in my head is the dipole moment of the other atoms.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you left off that we would have to do for one of these as well, or is it just you just divide by the epsilon?
That you have to ask Jim because he's a physicist. I'm a computer scientist. I have to take their word for it that they when they tell me that this ion placement method is scientifically sound. I just nod my head and if the legal
field is called representation.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll take your representation.
That's so I don't know the answer to that. Jim may know.
Well, we can take
I
it off.
Okay, I know that our method takes a lot less dangerous assumptions than the ones that people have been using so far. So that's, but I don't know whether dipole.
So we won't be held responsible if physics turns out not to work.
That's right. That's why they have to do the physics first, and the making it fast comes later after the physics is good. and then the next code, next project is. One of the things people do with pharmaceutical design is they try to find, let's say you have some disease, you have the 3D shape of the molecule, the biological organism that's being affected, the hormone or whatever. They have little pockets on them, and you want to get a tiny little pharmaceutical molecule to fit into that pocket. And so they do what are called docking simulations, where they calculate millions of orientations of the small molecule, and they try to fit it in that pocket. That calculation involves a potential grid type calculation, very similar to the one that I described. But they also have to do various masking and solving for other effects beyond that. So that project would be like this, but with some extra stuff involved in doing all these orientation tests and all that. Then another one is Monte Carlo sampling of protein conformations. So that's basically doing lots of random tests of these different bendings and shapes of the molecules. Once again, Jim can probably say more than I can. And basically evaluating those very quickly. And so once again, a CUDA implementation looks like it might be promising. And then the last one, which is one of mine also, is basically although people have done ray tracing on GPUs many times before, the previous generation hardware has had a lot of limitations in both the hardware and in the programming that prevented people from implementing some of the more sophisticated algorithms. There's no way you guys are going to have time in this class to do what would excite me, but there are steps to this that you could do tests of, for example, coming up with a strategy to use the latency hiding that is much more visibly expressed in a CUDA program than you could have done in, say, OpenGL shaders or things like that before. It should be possible to greatly accelerate some of the ray tracing algorithm in CUDA. And so even if you just did a brute force naive ray tracer with no acceleration structure, there may be various interesting things to learn with the latency hiding and finding ways to use what CUDA and G80 have that the other GPUs didn't before. So, and that's one that is my maybe pet favorite because that's one of my interests, and I have a multiprocessor ray tracer that you can steal all the source code you want. So,
another thing is, do you have any particular ideas that you would like to recruit your fellow classmates to work on? Anyone at this point? Anyone who's ready to share some ideas? Yes?
Well, I mentioned to you before about finding this kind of anger.
Stand up.
I've been interested in, but it's just the classic algorithm for solving Maxwell's equations.
I was going to say the same thing, man.
Okay.
It's a pretty popular algorithm, man. Practice mates, differential equation.
So, are you not an expert in that application? Or you could find an expert.
It's pretty easy. You could do simulations of waveguides and kind of crystals or any sort of thing.
So you're planning on doing a 3D implementation?
Well, I don't know. 2D first, at least.
I already have a 2D implementation with parallel on CPUs.
Okay, so you will be customized.
Sounds like you guys have a team.
Exactly.
Hey.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so if you could develop a preliminary project sheet, okay, and identify someone like Jimmy Jing or someone who could help to. You know, I could talk to Jimmy if you like.
Lots of people make parallel applications of this.
Yeah.
But
okay, so you're very interested. Any other, anyone else who has a thesis coming along and, who wants to have some,
I want his thesis done so I can use it.
Yeah. Okay, so if not, or if you still want to cook it up a little bit more, use the whiteboard. Okay, so use the whiteboard extensively in the next few weeks, trying to make it up. Okay.
For all the ones that we put up, we're trying to provide sample source code so you can actually hit the ground running and not have to start from scratch.
Okay, very good. Hey, thanks.
Sure. Thank you.